Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks so much for joining us. Today we're going to have a detailed conversation about the social history of marijuana. The author of a new book, the book is titled Smoke Signals, is Martin Lee, and he joins us by phone from Silver City, right, Martin?
Yes, good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Did you get much snow down there?
They got about 4 or 5 inches, I'd say. It's quite beautiful.
Good, good. Yeah, we got some in town here in Albuquerque also, and I can definitely say that my garden, when I walked out the door this morning, my garden seemed to be breathing a sigh of relief to have all that snow sitting there. Thanks so much for joining us. We are going to take your comments and calls this morning on what kinds of questions do you have about the history of marijuana used as a medicine, used as a recreational drug, policies around marijuana in the United States. These are some of the topics we're going to touch on this morning, and we'd like to invite you to join the conversation. The local number here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can post your comments online at KUNM.org. You can also email callinshow@KUNM.org, and we will work to get your comments or questions on the air with my news interns and my producers who are working on that. Martin, I wanted to start off with you. There's a lot of information in your book that was very, very new to my knowledge, and I am not an expert in any sense of the word, about marijuana in any way. And I wanted to see if you could start off a little bit with some of the history of the use of marijuana as an herb in ancient civilizations. That was something that I had been completely unaware of. I don't know if I just thought marijuana was born in 1960 or something, but...
Well, it does go way back. Marijuana has been used both as a medicine and as a fiber. It's a very important fiber crop from hemp. And it goes back actually to before recorded history. It's a plant that was considered one of the first actually to be used as an agricultural crop grown. But as a medicine, it actually appears, marijuana, in the first recorded medical text, the first pharmacopoeia from ancient China. It goes back to 2700 BC. And marijuana, which was called ma at that time in China, was considered one of the five elixirs of immortality. It was conceived of as a very important medicinal herb that conferred longevity and was listed as something useful for over 100 different ailments in ancient China. And what's interesting, just to flash forward a moment, in 19th century America, in the pharmacopoeias from the late 19th century, cannabis, the other word for marijuana, was also listed as a remedy for over 100 different ailments. So there is a continuity and a through line from the ancient times to the present. And one of the problems I think that the medical marijuana movement has from a PR perspective today is that people make so many claims for marijuana, the therapeutic uses, that it almost comes off like snake oil. And yet there is a historical precedent for this, a historical precedent for many claims being made for medical uses, and also some scientific validity to those claims we're finding today. But to get back to your question about the ancient uses for cannabis as a medicine, not just in China, as the herb moved from place to place, people considered it very valuable.
Where is considered to be the kind of origin of cannabis, and how did it spread?
Its origin is in the Kush Mountains, the foothills of the Himalayas in Central Asia, and it spread northward to China, southward to India, where it was adopted both in religious use and also as a medicine, from there to Persia, from there to Arab Middle East, into northern Africa, into southern Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and from there, ultimately, on the slave ships, cannabis seeds were taken over to the Western Hemisphere, and that's how it came over to the West. So it has a long history. And what's interesting is that whenever marijuana went to a new culture, it was never rejected. It always stayed there. It was always embraced as a medicine. It might become a point of controversy later in the culture, but it never left. Then it would travel on to another place. But Wherever marijuana has come in a different society, different culture, it remained there as a fixture. And it suggests that there's something that humans found intrinsically useful.
Well, and what about the function of the plant itself? And this, some people say, you know, it grows like a weed. It can grow in very diverse climates and conditions and is...
It's sort of adapted very easily for wherever it went. It can grow in mountaintops. It can grow in near desert. It can grow in subtropical or tropical climates. It's a very adaptable plant, ecologically speaking. And in that sense, it's easy to grow, relatively speaking. Even people today who grow it, whether illegally or for medical purposes, it's not rocket science involved in growing. It's a very friendly plant in that way.
We're taking your calls today. Martin Lee is the author of the book Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. And so bring your questions about this plant, the history of the use of this plant, political perspectives, and ideologies around use of the plant. We're interested in hearing from you this morning. 277-5866 is the local number to call. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866 or email callinshow@kunm.org. So you kind of start off in your book with this broad, global, you trace the movement of this plant through various cultures. And then kind of get to the part that I think I had the most experience with, and that's the civil rights movement and the 1960s in the United States. And talk a little bit about, that's the part of the history that we may be most familiar with. But can you take us back to the earlier parts of the 20th century?
Illegal in 1937. And at that time, there was fascism emerging in Europe, and there's really a parallel there, because in the United States, there was the reefer madness hysteria. I say hysteria because much of what was said about marijuana, the idea that if one had a few puffs of a marijuana cigarette, one would turn into a deranged criminal freak and go out and kill people. This was what was being projected by both the federal government and by news media. The Hearst Media Syndicate was really involved in pushing the notion of reefer madness. And this paralleled the rise of fascism in Europe. And it turns out Hearst was a supporter of fascism. And I think there's psychological similarities in that, you know, fascism is all about hatred and fear of the other, about bigotry and prejudice. In Europe, it was all about scapegoating the Jews. For reefer madness, it was about scapegoating the Mexicans and their loco weed. This was the alien intrusion into American society. And at that time, in the 1930s, it was the Depression, and there was budget cutbacks in the government, and the newly formed Federal Bureau of Narcotics, led by a man named Harry Anslinger. He had a problem. His whole department was on the chopping block. They were talking about eliminating it, and he had to come up with a reason to convince Congress and the American public that his department was much needed, and it not only shouldn't be eliminated, but the budget should be expanded. And that's why he jumped on board for the Reefer Madness campaign that the Hearst Syndicate was already promoting. It was to save his bureaucratic fiefdom, if you will. People never heard of the word marijuana, mostly in the United States. It was a Mexican word. To the extent that people had heard about what we now know as marijuana, it was the word cannabis that was used, and that was a word that would appear on many of the patent medicines and the tinctures and things that people, almost every family in America had that they were taking for medicinal purposes. It was very common. But that all ended as a result of the prohibition that was implemented in 1937.
Well, and I honestly think of early recipes for Coca-Cola. And the inclusion of cocaine in that beverage early on, is that the same time period that we're talking about here, where there were products that had intoxicants of various kinds that were, you know, at least initially not very well regulated or monitored?
regulations really didn't start until 1906 in that sense from the federal government. But the use of cannabis in tinctures and medicinal products in the United States goes back to the 1850s. It starts a little bit before coca was introduced into cocaine. And it was very widely used as a medicine, but people didn't associate that with marijuana. Marijuana was a word people never heard of in the United States, for the most part, except for Mexican migrants and so forth, who brought it from Mexico as a recreational drug and as a medicine. And it was because of that ignorance that Harry Anslinger was able to basically bamboozle Congress and the American people into implementing this prohibition, which I have to be very frank is really based on lies. There was no scientific basis for it. It was based on racism. Anslinger played upon fears in segregated America of sexual contact across color lines, and he's very explicit about this. He would say marijuana would cause white women to sleep with black men and this kind of thing. So we might look back upon that period and sort of wince or laugh or see it as ridiculous. But a lot of the same themes continue today. I call it reefer madness light. You know, Anslinger would talk about marijuana as the assassin of youth. And today we hear constantly from those who feel that marijuana should remain prohibited, that it's a great threat to youth. Unfortunately, lost amidst this discussion is, well, what are the real risks or the real benefits?
I'm going to pause you there because I'd like to come back to this risks and benefits conversation. But first, I want to take a call from Francisco in Albuquerque. Good morning, Francisco. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Thank you for doing this. No, I want to kind of in agreement here with the prohibition. It was basically an interesting time. And a large portion of the prohibition was based on ethnicity. You know, the fascist movement, you know, was very segregatory and looked at minority groups as being the root of all evil. And Hispanics were targeted with marijuana. And if you look at the history of this, you know, Hispanics, you know, we have to stop these immigrants from bringing in all these vile, evil drugs, and marijuana was targeted. That was a large part of it, and there was a large, you know, number of arrests of Latino and Mexicano people that were importing marijuana right after 1937.
Thanks for your call, Francisco. Did you have a comment on that, Martin? A follow-up.
In the 1920s, the economy was doing much better in the United States than it was in the 1930s with the Depression. At that time, many Mexican migrants who had been fleeing the violence of the Mexican Revolution came to the southwestern part of the United States and seeking jobs, seeking a better life, seeking some kind of work, and they more or less accepted, at least to a much larger degree than in the 1930s when the economy tanked, it went south. And all of a sudden, a lot of the Anglos are worried that, oh, the Mexicans are taking their jobs and that kind of thing. Those worries weren't the same in the 1920s, but in the 1930s, the economy changed. And it was very much like the caller said. And what struck me was, when I studied this, was to the extent when there was labor organizing very intensively going on in certain areas of the American Southwest and other parts of the country, for that matter, it was in those same areas that the arrests for marijuana were very high at that time, because there were state laws even before there was the federal law. And it seemed that the arrests were targeted not just simply for marijuana smoking, but for labor organizing, and the two went hand in hand. So it was really a social control issue here. When it comes down to prohibition, I think there's three factors. It's racism involved, social control, and money, ultimately.
Let's take another call. Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Cannabis was used to create canvases for the sailing ships. That's where canvas came from, the word cannabis. It was also a currency. It was also clothing. George Washington used clothing that was made from cannabis. And the Constitution was written on cannabis. So it has a longer history than people think. Thank you.
Martin, talk a little bit about the difference between hemp products and marijuana as a medicine and recreational drug, and the relationship between those two kind of branches of this story.
Well, it's really two branches of the same plant, in a sense, in that there are versions of cannabis, you might say, that are more for fiber, that can be used to make oil for industrial uses or for health uses from the seed. It can be used to make paper, as the caller just indicated. Because it's such a strong fiber, when hemp is part of the paper, it's very difficult to tear it. So that's why it's been used for currencies in many countries. It was seen as a rival to the cotton in terms of the fiber, but actually much stronger. And then again, you have this other side, that different versions of the plant. The flower is psychoactive. It has chemicals in it that connect to aspects of our brain that make people feel somewhat euphoric, or it may actually confer medicinal benefits. So you have this unique situation where the plant has kind of two faces to it. And throughout history, it's played out. And what's interesting is today there is not only efforts to legalize the plant for recreational and medical uses, but also legalize hemp, which was banned in 1937 as well, when marijuana was banned. It's for industrial uses. In Kentucky, Republicans and Democrats, prominent politicians now have introduced not only laws on the state level, but at the federal level, to legalize industrial hemp. So there's a lot going on in the culture now. There's a shift with respect to the plant and all its aspects.
We are taking your calls this morning. Martin Lee is the author of the book Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana. And we do have some callers hanging on the line. Please stay with us. We're going to take a very, very quick break. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call 277-5866. We're, of course, interested in your comments and feedback also. 877-899-5866 is the toll-free number to call. This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and we'll be right back with more from the phones.
Cottonwood Gulch leads wilderness expeditions and, for kids 10 to 18, summer treks focused on art, ecology, and archaeology of the Four Corners region. Backpack into remote wilderness, mountain peaks, and desert canyons. Perfect for artists, scientists, and archaeologists. Learn more and take an afternoon hike at an open house Saturday, February 23rd at the Bacheche Open Space, Alameda and Rio Grande, 3 p.m. Info at cottonwoodgulch.org. A message from the tax-exempt Cottonwood Gulch.
Meet the artists of the 31st Annual Dixon Studio Tour on Friday, November 2nd at the Collected Works Show from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Tool Shed. The show runs through the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, November 3rd and 4th from 9 to 5. Studio Tour artists offer workshops in a wide range of media for all ages and levels of experience. Register online or at the tour. For more info, visit dixonarts.org. A message from the tax-exempt Embudo Valley Arts Association.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We're talking about the social history of marijuana with the author of a new book on the topic. The book is called Smoke Signals. And the author's name is Martin Lee, and he joins us this morning. Also, just to mention that tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice, Martin will be speaking about his work. It's a free event. So for folks who would like to follow up with him after, we do have that information posted online at KUNM.org, along with the phone numbers to call in during the show. You can call 277-5866, or you can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. Now, let's go back to the phones. Harry in Red River, good morning. You're on the air. Harry, you still there? Harry might not have waited. Let's go to Tony in Albuquerque. Good morning, Tony. Can you
hear
me?
Good morning,
Elaine. Hi.
I had a question about the medical use and for pain abatement. I have a 94-year-old father who has a chronic pain issue. We've tried every single thing we can think of to help, and I was wondering if medical marijuana can be used without getting him high, because I don't think he would appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank
you. Okay. Thanks for your call, Tony. Martin, can you talk about the medicinal use of marijuana, and in this case, specifically for pain abatement? What can you tell us about that?
It's a good question. Actually, there are versions or strains of marijuana that are slightly psychoactive or not psychoactive at all, that won't get a person high. And one should look for strains that have cannabidiol, a particular compound in marijuana called cannabidiol, otherwise known as CBD. If that's in there to any appreciable degree, or if it's in there more than the THC, the high causer, the compound that gets a person stoned, as it were, if there's equal amounts or more CBD than THC, it's something that will not only be particularly good for pain, better than marijuana that's just THC dominant, which is also good for pain, incidentally. But if CBD is added to the THC, it would be exceptionally good for neuropathic pain. And this is borne out by many scientific studies, including studies on human subjects. There is actually a compound available, not in the United States, unfortunately, at least not yet, but it's in Canada and many European countries. It's called Sativex. It's produced by a company called GW Pharmaceuticals. And it's a mixture, a whole plant extract that includes equal amounts of CBD and THC, and it's been approved for use for neuropathic pain for multiple sclerosis patients, and it's being tested now, actually, it's in phase 3 clinical trials in the United States for using it for neuropathic pain for cancer patients, so that might be approved. So I think that might be a good way to go, and while nothing works always for everybody, we've heard very, very good reports about the CBD-rich strains for neuropathic pain.
Well, how critical is this question about getting high on marijuana compared to using marijuana for some kind of medicinal purpose? You did mention earlier that there are that historically there have been hundreds of ailments that different cultures have said, okay, we have figured out based on our medical practices that marijuana helps with these particular illnesses. And that's related to how, as you pointed out, there are a lot of different chemicals in the plant and in different strains of the plant. And can you talk about some of the specific illnesses that have been found to get beneficial results from use of marijuana, and why?
Well, pain certainly is one that's very, very important, and it's probably the most frequent complaint that doctors receive. People are in pain; they need something for it. And, but there's many, many different conditions. In the United States, initially, we heard about cannabis being very helpful for nausea when people were going through chemotherapy. You know, this it really takes the toll on the body, and it results in a lot of discomfort and toxicity and tremendous nausea. And, you know, a couple of puffs of marijuana just goes away. Sometimes it works for people when nothing else does. Then we heard about, during the period when AIDS emerged in the 1980s and 1990s, that cannabis was useful for anorexia, for people who are undergoing that wasting syndrome that's so much a part of the AIDS disease.
And that's because of the drug cocktails, right?
Yes.
That the drug cocktails created symptoms in people that they couldn't keep any food down.
Exactly, because of the toxic effects of the chemotherapy agents, whether for AIDS or for cancer for that matter. Very difficult to keep food down. People don't feel like eating as a result. And, well, everyone knows you smoke marijuana, you get the munchies. It's a common understanding among marijuana smokers. It provokes appetite. So it was seen medicinally as good for anorexia. And then from there, we heard reports about multiple sclerosis patients it being useful as an antispasmodic. But in recent years, as scientists have been focusing on this compound CBD that I just mentioned before, cannabidiol, it seems to open up a whole new vista of applications. Now they're talking about CBD-rich cannabis as good for metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, asthma. It's been used traditionally in cultures. And cancer also is another area, not just for dealing with nausea from chemotherapy. It turns out, and this is something that's not controversial anymore among scientists, this is understood to be proven, that certain of the cannabinoids, the compounds in marijuana, have very potent anti-cancer effects that have actually been shown to shrink tumors in animals, that have been shown to be effective on human cell lines also for stopping the proliferation of cancer. That's not to say, oh, that person go out and smoke marijuana and they won't get cancer or they'll get rid themselves of cancer. I'm not suggesting that. Bob Marley, the great reggae star, died of cancer. And if marijuana cured cancer, I think it would have helped him. But there's no doubt, scientists have shown that the compounds in marijuana definitely have anti-cancer effects. The CBD and THC both do. And we also get anecdotal reports, many now, of people using extracts, oils from cannabis, for their cancer and reporting very good results. Of course, we're not likely to hear from others who aren't having the good results, but there's no doubt for some it's a tremendous benefit.
Let's take another call. Max in Albuquerque. Good morning, Max. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Just fine, thank you.
Good. I wanted to add my two cents to this discussion because, and in a cautionary tone, because the history I know about, drugs like marijuana, et cetera, are that they basically serve two functions in a consumer culture that we live in. One, the first one is instant gratification. And the second one is that when people get tired or don't get as high from marijuana anymore, it becomes a gateway to, you know, other drugs like, heroin, et cetera, et cetera. And I also want to remind people that when England was running the world, the way that they introduced themselves to dominate China was to introduce the use of opium and turn everybody into addicts. And I think the last thing we need in this country is to, you know, have more addicts that need to get help. Now, I go along with the idea that marijuana has medicinal purposes or medicinal benefits, but I don't go along with the situation where the very sophisticated marijuana growing that goes on these days basically turns people into junkies looking for a better high, and so they go to other drugs, and so they start stealing to support their habits.
Martin, what has the research shown about the relationship between use of marijuana, recreational use of marijuana, and use of other drugs like heroin, cocaine, crack, meth, etc.?
Well, there's actually been several government commissions that have looked into this question, including one from the Institute of Medicine, which is considered kind of the gold standard. It's part of the National Academy of Sciences, that concluded very definitively that marijuana is not a gateway drug. It doesn't lead to harder drugs in the sense that there are chemicals in marijuana that compels a person to want to get more high. If anything, it seems that the opposite is true, in that when you have a situation where in a society or in a culture or in a particular place where people are consuming marijuana to a greater degree, then there's less consumption of harder drugs. You take the island of Jamaica, for example. It's the island that there's least consumption of alcohol throughout compared to other countries in the Caribbean. It's because there's most marijuana smoking. That's stepping aside from the question of, is this good for people to smoke marijuana? But in terms of its relation to other drugs, including the medical uses, it seems that people take less other drugs when they are using marijuana, at least in a broad sense. Now, you might have specific examples of people who just like to get high no matter what. I think the caller is right when he mentioned instant gratification. For a lot of people, that's what it is. The question is, why is it gratifying? Marijuana is not addictive like heroin or cocaine. It's not physically addictive, but it can be habituating, and I know people who just, they can't stop in the sense they're not capable of using it just a little. But it's the same for other drugs or alcohol. They can't use just a little. There's a certain percentage of people who, for whatever reason, are very vulnerable to addictions or habitual uses of drugs. And frankly, if they're going to have to use one rather than any other, probably marijuana is the safest and least harmful. It'd be better if they didn't do any, of course. But I think that it's been inverted. The gateway effect is largely a myth, and it's been shown to be that by many scientific studies and by commissions that the government has actually sponsored.
Let's take another call. We're talking about the social history of marijuana, and, of course, that's a very broad topic, so we're touching on a couple different areas this morning with author Martin Lee. He wrote the book Smoke Signals, and he'll be speaking about his book tomorrow night, Friday at 7 p.m. at the Albuquerque Peace and Justice Center. We do have information about that event posted online at KUNM.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, 277-5866 is the local number to call here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. If you get a busy signal, feel free to send us an email or to post your comments online, or just as soon as you hear one of our callers finish their comments, try again, and hopefully a line will have opened up. Let's go to Linda in Albuquerque. Good morning, Linda. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I was born and raised in Texas. I'm American. I'm a third-generation American. Family comes from Mexico. And I was telling the screener that it was perfectly natural for me as a small girl, as a young girl, to walk around my grandmother's house and notice alcohol containers, the green rubbing alcohol containers, with marijuana leaves inside. She had rheumatoid arthritis. She suffered badly. And it was just a very natural thing that she would ask me to, you know, go get the alcohol, and I'd pour it on her feet and on her hands, and I'd sit there and rub her feet and her hands for her because it relieved her arthritis pain. And it was just a normal, natural thing. She had a marijuana bush growing in her flower garden in front of the house. My grandparents were business owners. They were popular in the neighborhood. And I'll never forget, in the 70s, again, I was a young girl, cops coming to the house and saying, Ms. Chapa, you know, you can't have that plant growing in the garden, you know, you know that's illegal. And she's, you know, just trying to explain to them that it's for her arthritis. And they had to take it away. I remember them having to pull it out and take it. And I remember my hippie John Lennon lookalike uncle just very upset about that, just as upset as my grandmother. But yeah, it was just a normal thing to see that and to help her with the arthritis. I didn't think anything was wrong with it until I grew up and realized, oh, that's marijuana and that's illegal. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know that even in the 70s, it was, you know, grandmothers were using it for their arthritis.
Great. Thanks, Linda. Let's go to John in Placitas. Good morning, John. You're on the air. John, are you there? What about Jill in Albuquerque?
This is Jill.
Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
I work in the health field, and I've seen a lot of the benefits of medical marijuana and even encountered a lot of patients that use marijuana illegally, but for medicinal, but seem to be for medicinal uses, not just recreational. So I know there are benefits. I just wanted to mention that unless you're growing marijuana yourself or you're getting it from someone who grows it here, I think it's good to keep in mind that most of the marijuana that people are smoking in the U.S. comes from Mexico, and it's something like 65% of what's supporting the drug cartels and bringing a lot of violence not only to Mexico but now into the U.S. So that's just a good thing to keep in mind about who you're supporting. So I would say you probably should grow it yourself if you're going to use it. The other point I wanted to make is that I lived in Jamaica for a few years, and it's really not true that alcohol is not a problem there. It's a horrific problem there. Alcoholism is just, it's really rampant in Jamaica. There's very little marijuana smoking outside of, actually, construction workers smoke marijuana for work. It's not considered a recreational thing. And then there's, you know, there are a few religious groups that do some, but it's really not common among the average person. There are also little old ladies who use it in their tea in Jamaica, but it's not a common drug, and it certainly doesn't take the place of alcohol. That's just the point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thanks, Jill. Let's go to CR in Albuquerque. Good morning, CR. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I have a question, and it is... I mean, a marijuana is something that you smoke, you inhale it into your lungs, you hold it there for a while, and then you exhale. Is that, you know, unhealthy to be taking that smoke into your lungs like that? Have they studied that at all? Thank you very much. Bye.
Martin.
Yes, there have been very interesting studies about that. And I just should point out that there are other ways to consume marijuana. One can eat it, one could have it as a tincture, one can take droplets, one can apply it as a topical, and of course one can inhale it, either smoking it or now they have these vaporizers that allow one to inhale the fumes but not the actual combusted smoke. The United States government, through the National Institute of Drug Abuse, states that there are more carcinogenic compounds in marijuana than tobacco when they're combusted, when they're smoked, that it releases this dangerous material. And they're actually correct on that. But what they don't say, and this is the intellectual dishonesty that really I find galling, is that when the studies have been done, the real-life studies, by the same scientists who reported that if you take the individual components of tobacco and marijuana, compare them, actually marijuana has more carcinogens, those scientists later did follow-up studies sponsored by the U.S. government. Donald Tashkin, a professor from the UCLA, he was the leading lung expert for the government studying marijuana. And he concluded that when he compared over 1,000 either cigarette smokers or people who just smoked marijuana, people who smoked nothing, or people who smoked both tobacco and marijuana, a startling conclusion he found. Not only was there no link at all between marijuana smoking and lung cancer, but that the marijuana smokers, if they just smoked marijuana, nothing else, actually were slightly less likely to get lung cancer than a person who smoked nothing. And the reason for this, again, is because you have very potent medicinal compounds in marijuana that when you smoke it, you're also inhaling those compounds. So they neutralize the effect of the carcinogens in the marijuana smoke, and that's why you don't get lung cancer. So this is a very interesting study, and Donald Tashkin, who was a real, sort of diehard drug warrior, when he did those studies, he was an honest man, and now he's come out basically for legalizing marijuana because he realized that one of the dangers that have been trumpeted often in terms of lung damage is really not much to it. It could irritate the lungs, but it will not cause lung cancer.
We've got an email question asking for you, Martin, to explain the characters in this story, so to speak, who are opposed to legalizing marijuana. And he's thinking specifically about drug companies, tobacco companies, and liquor companies. Do those folks figure into the kind of the political economy?
Well, as a journalist, I really want to go with what I can prove for sure. I don't want to speculate too much, or if I'm going to speculate, I have to say speculation. In terms of the forces who are against changing the law, against legalizing, I think it's mainly law enforcement in the United States that has, in some ways, the most to lose from a change in this regard. I'm skeptical when it comes to seeing the drug companies here as the enemy, for example. What the drug companies are mainly interested in with marijuana is how to make money from it, how to isolate specific compounds, patent them for specific uses with unique distribution or dissemination techniques, and make a lot of money from them. I don't think legalization or illegalization of marijuana is really what they're focusing on, from what I gather from my work as a journalist. Now, that might be, for all I know, backroom meetings and among big pharma executives saying that we got to stop this plan from being legalized because the more people that smoke it, the less they'll use our drugs. Maybe those conversations are going on, but I'm not privy to it, and I don't see any evidence. With tobacco companies, I would think they're licking their chops, waiting for it to become become legal nationwide, so they can mass produce it. And as for alcohol companies, well, in California, when they had the proposition a couple of years ago to legalize marijuana, it failed. There was some small donations made by the alcohol industry to the effort toward keeping it illegal. But I don't see, if they really were oriented toward this fixated on it, I would think they would give a lot more money. Ultimately, I think the alcohol industry will be able to thrive and coexist perfectly well with legal marijuana. That's how it's been for most of, human history. People have used alcohol. People have used marijuana. Some people use both. I see really the main problem here, law enforcement.
Let's go to the phones again. Harry in Red River, thanks for holding, and you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It would seem that William Randolph Hearst had a number of different motivations when he first produced Reefer Madness. He was very concerned about losing his vertical monopoly. He had trees, he had forests, he had pulp plants, and hemp was threatening the paper industry. He was primarily concerned, at least that's what the story was back in the Bay Area in the 1960s, that he was primarily concerned about the role that paper produced by hemp could his profit line. And he was more concerned about the hemp side of cannabis than he was about the recreational, social, or racial implications.
Thank you for your call, Harry. Let's go to Joe in Socorro. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Actually, the prior statements he made about it being a law enforcement issue took some teeth away from my initial reason for calling. I'm actually part of the cannabis program here in the state. I am a veteran with PTSD, and actually, right now, I've had to talk to my mental health care provider and switch me over to something traditional to treat my PTSD because, you know, in the economy right now, I'm trying to get a job anywhere I can, and it's kind of up, even though I'm protected by the state, it's kind of up to the employer whether or not I can use my medicine. And
Joe, do you find that because it sounds to me like you're using marijuana medicinally as treatment for your PTSD, but then finding that the stigma that's associated with using marijuana is preventing you from being able to get a job?
I don't know if it's so much the stigma, but just the federal law that. The difference between the federal and state laws that are butting heads, you know, it just puts me in a catch-22. And, you know, I have a family and stuff I got to provide for. But so now I'm taking the trazodone to treat my PTSD. It knocks me out so I can sleep at night. Kind of helps with anxiety during the day. But they've tried me on benzodiazepines, and they just put me on my butt. I can't. Like I'm drunk, like a dry drunk 24/7. Cannabis just, you know, mellowed me out, made me not so anxious, able to go to sleep. It wasn't really a big deal, but so I'm kind of in this juxtaposition. And just to address also the stigma about it being a gateway drug, you know, everyone starts out drinking milk, and if they graduate to being an alcoholic, who's to say that the milk wasn't the gateway drug for them, you know?
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for calling in this morning. Let's take a call now from Judith in Albuquerque. Judith, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. And I have a quick question, and your guest already touched upon it. But over 60 years ago, I learned that the tobacco industry was already geared up to manufacture tobacco in cigarettes. Can your guest possibly estimate possible loss of revenue had those things been going on for the last 60 years?
Meaning if marijuana had been legalized and regulated and being mass-produced and then being taxed. Martin, what do you think?
It's hard for me to calculate. It would be a lot of money. You know, the estimates are that marijuana today as an illicit industry is $35 billion, and obviously if that was taxed, the government would be, at all levels, be gaining revenue that could be put to good use. But the several things have been said by recent callers. I was struck by the caller with PTSD. As far as I know, that within the New Mexico program for medical marijuana, PTSD is the leading condition that's being treated. And it's not a majority, but of all the conditions that people are registering for, PTSD is the number one condition.
So, Martin, why is marijuana a treatment for PTSD? What do the chemicals in marijuana do to a brain of somebody who is suffering from PTSD? How does that actually function?
Well, you know, honestly, one could speak for hours on this, but in a nutshell, two things we know for sure. The cannabis has a
it interacts with receptors in the brain that mediate stress. So what happens is when one is feeling stress in the body for any reason, whether it's from a bad memory, a traumatic incident, or just a tough day at work, whatever, there are stress hormones in the body circulating at that moment when you're feeling stress. And what these receptors that respond to marijuana do is literally turn down the functioning of those hormones, in the sense that they limit the production of those hormones, turn it down like a dimmer switch, so you feel less stressful physiologically and psychologically. The other thing is that scientists have found that in areas of the brain associated with trauma and memory, the cannabinoids, the compounds in cannabis, actually dilate the blood vessels in the brain, so to allow more blood to flow through these areas and more oxygen, and that has a therapeutic effect. And there's much more in this area, but so much of it is new in a way. This is pioneering research that's being done. But there's no question that marijuana could be very, very helpful for PTSD.
One of the things that you wrote in your book is that Americans tend to medicate. We tend to medicate ourselves for a lot of different things, and especially for things like depression or anxiety, and some of the things like PTSD. Those are symptoms of PTSD. Can you talk about your theory in a way that many Americans self-medicate with marijuana instead of medicating with a legal prescription drug?
Well, you know, why do people smoke marijuana? You can dismiss it and say a lot of people just having fun, having a good time. That's a part of it. But when people try it and they start using it regularly, whether it's once a week, once a month, or some people it's every day, there's got to be something more going on. And it's not just a matter of people becoming addicted and have to use a drug, because marijuana is not physically addicting. So it's providing something. And I do think in the 1960s, when a lot of people first started smoking marijuana in the United States, millions of people for the first time, and my sense of it is that that was a kind of a self-medication, not in a conscious sense, not that people were sitting around their college dorm room and saying, okay, gee, I'm feeling stressed out, so let me take this medication, marijuana. It's a kind of an unconscious thing, but it does relieve stress, and stress in a general sense. And in our society in the 1960s, that generation coming of age really is the first generation to come of age being aware that we have the weapons of mass destruction that can end human civilization. This is the first generation growing up with that knowledge, growing up exposed to all these different synthetic chemicals in the environment, all of which put stress on us physiologically, growing up with all kinds of different stressors. And if anything, it's gotten more and more intense with all the Wi-Fi today and all these different things, the radiation in the environment. These things take their toll on the body, and the receptors in the body that respond to cannabis, it turns out they're like our first line of defense to try to mediate these stresses. But when it gets it's too much stress, this system, which is called the endocannabinoid system, our internal cannabinoid system, tends to wear down, tends to get, I don't want to say used up, but just wear down is the right phrase. And when that happens, people become increasingly vulnerable to getting ill. As one ages, our endocannabinoid system, these receptors weaken, and we become more vulnerable to illness as we get older.
Let me take another call from Mike in El Rito. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. I've been smoking marijuana for 40 years since I was in Korea in the Army, and it's been real hard to keep it going without going to jail, and the medical marijuana program here in New Mexico isn't real easy to get in on. I have two sister-in-laws that have died in their 30s from smoking cigarettes, and I myself had smoked them for over 30 years and had a hard time getting off of them. And I know that you can go down to the liquor store and buy a bottle of liquor and kill yourself on one bottle. And I've never known anybody to die from overdosing off of marijuana. Thank you.
Martin, what are the statistics on death from overdose on marijuana?
Well, you can't die from marijuana from an overdose physiologically, because these receptors I've been referring to, they're not on the brain stem. you know, opiates have receptors also in the brain that are in the brainstem. You take too much, you can die. You can stop breathing, the heart can stop beating, but that's not the case for marijuana. There might be other problems with it, the way people use it, but not in the sense that you can die. And there's never been a recorded case in history from that.
Let's go to Larry in Wyoming. Good morning, Larry. You're on the air.
Good morning. Just got one question. Growing up, all you ever heard about smoking pot, I want to know if it's a myth or not, it burned brain cells. Is that true or is that a myth?
I'm thinking of that 1980s drug war commercial, the fried egg in the frying pan, this is your brain on drugs. I was in grade school in the early 80s, and Martin, does marijuana burn or kill brain cells?
No, the compounds in marijuana are not toxic to the human brain, and they're not toxic to the human body. You don't get high from marijuana as a result of a toxic insult to the nervous system, as is the case for alcohol. And again, scientists have shown this. You know, and what they've concluded is that the system of receptors in the brain that marijuana activates has a protective effect against degeneration, and in fact, can stimulate the growth of and the creation of new brain cells. That's what they're finding. This is one of the most amazing areas that I've come across in this science, that this system of receptors actually regulate what's called neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain can actually regenerate itself. That's what they're finding with the cannabinoid compounds in marijuana. It's just the opposite of the reefer madness scenario.
Let's go to Lloyd in Albuquerque. Lloyd, good morning. You're on the air. Maybe Lloyd wasn't able to hang on with us long enough. Let's go to Only, calling from New Mexico. Good morning, Only. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. A lot of palabras and so a lot of statistics and everything about it, but it all really just comes down to free the weed. And the rest of it's just, you know, anecdotal evidence and statistics and stuff. But it's such a hoax that somebody would have to go to jail for having a weed in their yard. And the government lies about it. We know they lied about it. And in the East Coast, they used the black community as a scapegoat with the fear. So that's about my comment. I just say, free the weed. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Only. Martin, we just have a few moments left, and I want to kind of have you bring us up to date in, we've talked a little bit about the science and kind of the cutting edge science in research on cannabinoid behavior in the brain. And we've got, you know, several states around the nation that have either legalized recreational use of marijuana and or medicinal use. There are states that have lowered the penalty for possession. For example, here in New Mexico at our session up in Santa Fe, there's at least two pieces of legislation that have been introduced, one of them by Democratic Senator Gerald Ortiz Pino, that is requesting that the New Mexico Economic Development Department study marijuana legalization to see what kind of tax benefit that might have for the state. We've also got another bill introduced by a Democratic representative, Emily Kane, that would lower the penalties for possession of certain amounts of marijuana. Is this kind of process towards legalization something that you see as eventually going to happen?
It seems that it's inevitable, and it's already well on the way with marijuana being legalized for adult use in Washington, Colorado, as of last November. But you know, there's nothing guaranteed here. Things could change very, very quickly around this policy. I think when you consider how quickly the Cold War suddenly ended, the Berlin Wall collapsed, and Soviet bloc communism no longer exists 2 years later. You know, but that seemed like a fixture when we were growing up. It would never end the Cold War. You know, marijuana prohibition is is built on a very tenuous foundation. There's not a lot of substance there, and I think this could change very, very quickly as well, or it might drag on for a lot longer because there are vested interests.
So I'm gonna have to stop you there, Martin. Martin Lee is the author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. He'll be speaking at the Albuquerque Peace and Justice Center tomorrow night at 7 p.m. You can find more details about that event online at KUNM.org. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show. Next week, we'll speak with Paul Ingalls, producer of Peace Talks Radio. The show has won its second Paul Ray Peace Prize. That's next Thursday morning at 8 on the KUNM Call-In Show. Thanks for listening.